Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso. A Lakeside man who was shot 16 times by sheriff's deputies in El Cajon is suing the county and the officers who opened fire. Find out about conflicting findings by the district attorney and the county's Citizens Law Enforcement Review Board on our show today. The City of La Mesa and the DA's office are teaming up to hold a hate crimes forum on December 14th after anti-Semitic flyers were disseminated in La Mesa and nearby communities. From California News Service, we'll have a report today on what's at stake with Republican efforts to repeal the Affordable Care Act. A citrus fruit quarantine has been imposed by agricultural officials in Valley Center after a disease that's deadly to citrus trees was found there. Learn more in our agricultural report. County health officials have issued a public health advisory over whooping cough cases in our region. Are your vaccinations up to date to protect yourself from this disease? Find out on our show today. In La Mesa, opposition to proposed electronic billboards is growing, with an online petition and now a Grossmont Center Regional Shopping Mall weighing in against plans for giant flashing signs along Interstate 8. The state's first care court is opening in Los Angeles to help assure that mentally ill people on our streets get the care that they need. From Public News Service, we'll have some national election stories, including the latest on a court case that seeks to keep Donald Trump off the Colorado ballot for inciting an insurrection, Georgia redistricting that may violate the Voting Rights Act, and fake electors in Wisconsin who now acknowledge that Joe Biden won the 2020 presidential race. In honor of Pearl Harbor Day, we'll be re-airing our interview with Dr. Kenneth Hansen. He recently passed away, but it's important to keep his memories of the Pearl Harbor attack alive. Many local listeners may remember Dr. Hansen, a well-known La Mesa physician, but they may not be aware that as a young boy in Honolulu, he delivered messages from the U.S. military base to the hospital treating those wounded in the Pearl Harbor bombing, becoming inspired to pursue his career in medicine. We'll also share some East County history with you, the story of a baby born on Christmas Eve, no, not in Bethlehem, but in Carrizo Gorge right here in East County during the long-ago De Anza expedition. And finally, there is good news for Lemon Grove residents, grant funds to dramatically upgrade Lemon Grove Park with new modern play equipment that will be accessible to all. So stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters.
This is East County Magazine's Crime Beat. On the streets, reporting on crimes impacting communities across our region, helping to keep you safe and informed.
A Lakeside man who suffered permanent injuries from being shot 16 times has filed a lawsuit against San Diego County and two sheriff's deputies who opened fire. The civil lawsuit filed by Eric Talavera alleges that deputies David Lovejoy and Jonathan Young gave conflicting commands and used excessive force and negligence during the incident in El Cajon on February 16, 2022. Talavera was pulled over for driving a van towing a stolen trailer. The trailer, which had a tracking device, was bait in a sting operation set up by the county's anti-auto theft task force. According to the suit, Talavera was homeless when he took the trailer. He pleaded guilty to the theft, as well as to a misdemeanor offense for a knife that he possessed. He was sentenced to probation. Sheriff's body cam video confirms that Talavera had exited the vehicle when one deputy ordered him not to move, while the other ordered him to get on the ground. The suit claims he was trying to get on the ground when deputies opened fire, shooting him 12 times, then firing twice more after he was on the ground. One shot also accidentally struck a National City police officer, Detective Rowdy Powell, who was part of the auto theft task force. Detective Powell has also sued the county over the shooting, alleging that the officers started shooting without a warning while the suspect was moving towards the ground. His suit contends that the shootings were reckless and that stray bullets also struck nearby homes. The officers claim that Talavera told them, "Just shoot me," before they turned on the body cameras, but there is no video or witness testimony to substantiate that allegation. The deputies were about 40 feet away when they opened fire. The lawsuit states Mr. Talavera did not threaten any member of law enforcement, nor would a reasonable deputy interpret Mr. Talavera's conduct as a threat of violence or endangering anyone. However, the deputies were cleared of criminal wrongdoing following an investigation by the district attorney. The DA found that Talavera created a deadly force situation by pulling a metallic black object from his waistband, an item both deputies believed could have been a small firearm. Despite being told not to reach for the object, Talavera clutched the knife close to his body. But even after the knife was released and on the pavement, Deputy Lovejoy fired two more shots that struck Talavera. Talavera's attorney, Marcus Barassa, told 10 News, "It's criminal because at that point he knows that Mr. Talavera doesn't pose any danger to him." The county Citizens Law Enforcement Review Board came to a different conclusion than the DA, finding that Talavera was complying with commands and was facing away from the deputies when they opened fire. Talavera, in a wheelchair, spoke out at a rally recently, surrounded by supporters wearing T-shirts proclaiming, "Justice for Eric Talavera." He spent months in the hospital for wounds that will require lifelong care, according to the lawsuit, including a bullet lodged in his leg that cannot be removed, leaving him in pain and unable to work. At the rally, Talavera said, "I can't bend my waist. I'm still working on walking. I can't even eat regular food, take a regular shower, or even tie my shoes. But somehow, I survive." The Sheriff Department does not comment on pending litigation, and the county spokesperson has declined comment in requests from multiple media outlets. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, your network for social justice, this is John Tidwell.
A representative of District Attorney Summer Steffen and the La Mesa Police Department invite community members to a hate crimes forum with a Q&A session on December 14th at 5:30 p.m. at the La Mesa Police Department. The forum comes on the heels of anti-Semitic flyers repeatedly disseminated in La Mesa, as well as nearby San Diego communities, including Del Cerro, San Carlos, and Allied Gardens in recent months. Some flyers blamed Jews for the 9/11 attacks, among other false claims. Fabian Perloff, executive director of the Anti-Defamation League San Diego chapter, told the San Diego Union-Tribune, "Their goal is creating fear and anxiety in our communities." The flyers were distributed by the Goyim Defense League, a white supremacist group, according to Leora Rez, executive director of the nonprofit Stop Antisemitism. The flyers first appeared locally around June. The leafleting of residents' homes has continued since Hamas attacked and killed hundreds of Israelis, also taking hostages, triggering Israeli attacks on Gaza that have killed thousands. The Hamas-Israel war has sparked a rise in anti-Semitism worldwide, as well as hate crimes against Muslims. In the city of San Diego, Councilman Raul Campillo plans to introduce an ordinance that would create a new crime, hate littering. That would be less serious than violent hate crimes, but enable communities to ban distribution of flyers that could incite violence against any specific group, such as Jews, Muslims, Asians, or the LGBTQ community, for example. Carrie Shaw, policy staffer for Councilman Campillo, says the draft ordinance is currently being vetted by the city attorney to assure it can withstand any constitutional challenge on First Amendment free speech grounds. Campillo also wants to address the issue more broadly to assure that the city creates a safe space for victims to get help and resources, and to address the reasons behind the surge in hate flyers. Shaw says this is Councilman Campillo's number one policy priority, adding that the ordinance could come before the San Diego City Council within a week or two after being heard first in committee in January or February. If approved, A person found guilty of distributing hate flyers aimed at inciting violence could spend up to a year in jail and/or face a fine of up to $1,000. La Mesa Councilman Jack Hsu told East County Magazine in a phone interview, "I haven't heard of this type of ordinance before, but it's something I'd be interested in looking into. An ordinance regarding hate literature may be helpful, but," he adds, "I hope it can also work on preventative measures with regard to hate." He voiced concern over hate targeting both recent immigrants and those of foreign ancestry who have been in the U.S. for generations, such as Chinese Americans targeted during the COVID-19 pandemic, which some blamed on China, where it originated. He likens preventative actions, such as community forums and educational efforts, as addressing hate from a public health perspective, instead of waiting for a crime to occur. Councilman Hsu concludes, "We can reduce hate if we have a conscious effort to do so." He urges all concerned citizens to attend the Hate Crimes Forum on December 14th in La Mesa, adding, "When you team up, you win." Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery.
Advocates for affordable health care are speaking out to remind people what's at stake if the Affordable Care Act is repealed in the wake of recent statements by former President Donald Trump. Mr. Trump, who leads in the polls for the 2024 Republican nomination, has recently said he's looking at alternatives to the Affordable Care Act and criticizes the GOP lawmakers who voted against his attempts to end the ACA in 2017. Laura Packard, a stage 4 cancer survivor, notes that before the ACA, insurance companies were allowed to deny coverage to people like her with pre-existing conditions.
While I was on the couch trying to survive, that's when Republicans in the U.S. House voted to repeal the Affordable Care Act that was keeping me alive, and then they held a party to celebrate. We can't go back to that.
The ACA created health exchanges like Covered California that offer subsidized health insurance to millions of people. And it funded an expansion of Medi-Cal that benefited 5 million low-income Californians in the first 6 years after the law's passage. Senator Ron Wyden of Oregon, who helped write the health care law, says the ACA forces health insurance companies to cover basic services like maternity care, mental health services, cancer screenings, and contraception. The idea of getting rid of the law has been largely unpopular, and Wyden knows why.
It would mean higher premiums for families and health insurance, and it would also threaten Medicaid nursing home benefits, because Medicaid is paying much of the nursing home bill for this country.
The law also allows adult children to stay on their parents' health plans until age 26 and bans lifetime caps on coverage. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
This is John Tidwell with East County Magazine's Agriculture Report. The California Department of Food and Agriculture has declared a new citrus quarantine in Valley Center after detecting the fatal citrus tree disease known as Huanglongbing, or HLB, also called citrus greening, in 5 orange trees on a residential property during regular inspections. This bacterial disease is a major threat to San Diego County's $138 million a year citrus crop and can also impact residential citrus tree owners. HLB causes misshapen, bitter fruit and eventually kills infected trees. There are over 120 growers with approximately 1,100 acres of commercial citrus and 120 nurseries that may have citrus trees within the Valley Center quarantine. The commodities on these Valley Center properties are valued at over $19 million. This new quarantine adds to the existing HLB quarantines in the cities of Oceanside and Rancho Bernardo. It covers the area bordered on the north by the intersection of I-76 and Pala, to the south by I-15 and Deer Springs Road, to the west by Camino del Rey, and to the east by Valley Center. The goal of the quarantine is to protect the food supply, support the agricultural economy and environmental sustainability by restricting people and businesses from moving citrus, nursery stock, plant parts, and fruit outside the quarantine boundaries and off their properties. The only exception is for agricultural businesses that must adhere to specific requirements for treatment, cleaning, and packing commercial fruit prior to movement. The disease is not harmful to people or animals, but it is deadly to citrus and could be devastating to the county's citrus industry. HLB is spread by tiny insects, the Asian citrus psyllid, if they are carrying the HLB bacterium when they feed on citrus trees. Samples from trees on the property where HLB was confirmed, as well as the surrounding area, are undergoing tests for the disease. San Diego Agricultural Commissioner Ha Don says, unfortunately, Huanglong Bing is fatal to citrus, so our goal is to prevent this disease from spreading any farther. He adds, partnering with state and federal regulatory partners, we are working closely with residents and agricultural operators and ask for everyone's cooperation with the ongoing regulatory activities. The California Department of Food and Agriculture and County Department of Agriculture Weights and Measures will work with residents in the immediate area to arrange for treatment of citrus trees as a protective measure against the disease. County officials are notifying local growers, plant nurseries, and other related businesses. If the disease is found in more citrus trees in the quarantine area, state officials will contact property owners about removal of infected trees. Nearby trees will be treated and regulatory survey efforts will be increased to prevent spread of the disease. Infected trees may have mottled yellow leaves, often in asymmetrical patterns. The trees will bear small, asymmetrical fruits, which are partly green, bitter, and not fit for sale or eating. The disease destroys the economic value of the trees and causes the infected trees to die within a few years. Inside the quarantine area, residents are urged to take the following steps. Do not move citrus plants, leaves, or foliage into or out of the quarantine area. Cooperate with agricultural officials who are inspecting trees, taking samples, and treating for the pest. If residents no longer wish to care for a citrus tree, consider contacting a tree removal service to help ensure trees do not continue to be a host to the pest and disease. Only buy citrus trees from reputable local nurseries. Report citrus trees that seem to be sick or dying, even if they also are well-watered and well-maintained, by contacting the state's toll-free pest hotline at 1-800-491-1899 or visit the California Department of Food and Agriculture's website at cdfa.ca.gov.
A free press is the foundation of our democracy. KNSJ Radio is dedicated to providing nonprofit news in the public interest, not special interests. We rely on your support to continue bringing you important stories from San Diego and East County that you won't hear anywhere else. Please make a generous donation at knsj.org to sustain KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso in the heart of San Diego's East County.
This is Miriam Raftery with a health alert. San Diego County health officials are warning about a rise in cases of pertussis, better known as whooping cough, and they're recommending that people get vaccinated, especially those most at risk of becoming seriously ill. The number of whooping cough illnesses jumped from 12 in September to 57 in October. Spikes happen every 3 to 5 years with this disease. The last peak was in 2017. The current rise in illness reports is the first since the COVID-19 pandemic, when prevention steps also kept pertussis down. Dr. Wilma Wooten, the county public health officer, says we're seeing pertussis spreading in rates similar to before the pandemic. This is concerning because we know that post-pandemic many people are experiencing vaccine fatigue, yet what we have learned over the last several years is that vaccines, hand-washing, masking, and other precautions help curb the spread of illness. Pregnant women and people who come into close contact with young infants are strongly urged to be vaccinated. Newborns are especially susceptible to pertussis since they are too young to be fully vaccinated. A typical case of pertussis starts with a cough and runny nose for a week or two, followed by weeks to months of rapid coughing fits that sometimes end with a whooping sound. Fever, if present, is usually mild. Antibiotics can lessen the severity of symptoms and prevent spread of disease to others. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention recommends the following schedule for the Tdap vaccination that helps protect people from pertussis as well as tetanus and diphtheria. A Tdap booster is recommended for pregnant women early in their third trimester and during each pregnancy to protect their newborns. Young children need 5 doses of Tdap by kindergarten at 2 months, 4 months, 6 months, 15 to 18 months, and 4 to 6 years of age. After that, the first Tdap booster is due at age 11 years. All students entering 7th grade are required to have proof of a whooping cough booster immunization. 1 dose of Tdap is recommended for adults 19 years of age and older if they didn't get Tdap as a teenager. After that, getting a Tdap vaccination instead of the standard tetanus shot every 10 years will also reduce infections. Parents can obtain the vaccine series and the booster shot for their children and themselves through their primary care physicians. Local retail pharmacies also offer vaccinations for a fee, and anybody who's not covered by a medical insurance plan can get the shot from a county public health center at minimal or no cost. For more information about whooping cough and ongoing vaccination clinics, call the county's immunization branch at 866-358-2966.
An online petition started by Keep La Mesa Beautiful in opposition to the city's plan to allow electronic billboards has attracted over 400 signatures since it launched on November 21. Now, the new owner of Grossmont Center has sent a letter to the city's mayor and city council opposing 2 proposed e-billboards along Interstate 8 as detrimental to the regional shopping mall. Scott Valley, Senior Vice President of Western Regional Development, authored the letter as a representative of Grossmont Center's new owner, Federal Realty. He notes that the new owner has made a significant commitment in purchasing the mall and a goal to continue serving the community with stores, restaurants, and services. Valley argues that 2 digital billboards proposed on Murray Drive and visible from I-8 could be to the detriment of Grossmont Shopping Center's marketability as a regional destination retail site by impeding freeway drivers' view of Grossmont Center and its signs. He states in the letter, "Our shopping center's static signs won't compete well for a driver's attention against the large, bright, digital displays that are being proposed. The mall ownership supports a non-commercial city sign, however, that is also included in the city's proposal." Valley asks, "Is this sort of advertising opportunity only available to advertising companies that already own billboards that can be removed and leveraged to a more lucrative sign location?" He suggests this is inequitable, adding, "Would Grossmont Shopping Center be awarded similar digital media rights to try to preserve our retailers' signage and branding interests?" Councilman Jack Hsu has argued against allowing e-billboards based on both aesthetic and safety concerns, citing the risk of distracted motorists causing accidents and potential legal liability for the city if e-billboards contribute to crashes. An East County Magazine investigation obtained California Highway Patrol records on accidents along I-8 East and West through the city of La Mesa from Lake Murray Boulevard on the west to Chase Avenue in El Cajon, since 1 billboard site would be near the La Mesa-El Cajon boundary. We also asked for data on accidents on on-ramps connecting I-8 and State Route 125. The data reveals that from January 1st, 2018 to October 10th, 2023, there were 1,805 accidents in those locations. Those accidents resulted in 20 fatalities and 673 injuries. On its petition, the Steering Committee for La Mesa Beautiful notes the city's small-town charm and unique character, adding that as a Tree City USA, La Mesa has always been a symbol of beauty, cleanliness, and safety. However, this identity is now under threat due to a proposal to allow for the construction of large digital billboards along the I-8 and 125 interchange. The petition states these giant flashing billboards will not only disrupt our tranquil community, but also threaten our quality of life. The American Association of Highway Transportation Officials states that digital billboards can cause significant driver distraction, leading to potential road safety issues. The petition concludes, La Mesa's charm lies in its simplicity and natural beauty, not in flashy digital displays that will mar its landscape. Concerned residents can find the No Electronic Billboards in La Mesa petition at change.org or on our website at eastcountymagazine.org. Reporting for East County Magazine in La Mesa, this is John Tidwell.
The East County Magazine Show airs Mondays and Fridays on KNSJ from 5 o'clock to 6 o'clock p.m. You can listen live at 89.1 FM or online at knsj.org. You can also listen anywhere by downloading the TuneIn application for your smartphone. For details, visit tunein.com.
California's largest county has just opened the new Care Court system, designed to get help for severely mentally ill people in Los Angeles. CARE stands for Community Assistance, Recovery, and Empowerment, a court where families, roommates, social workers, first responders, and clinicians can petition a judge to get people the assistance they need. L.A. County Superior Court Presiding Judge Samantha Jessner says a person must be 18 or older and participation is voluntary.
They must be diagnosed within the schizophrenia and other psychotic disorders class. They must be unlikely to survive safely in the community without support. Participation in a care plan must be the least restrictive alternative.
The National Alliance on Mental Illness in California supports the care courts, noting that people suffering from schizophrenia are sometimes unable to recognize their diagnosis, are resistant to treatment, and too often end up homeless and fighting addiction. Some disability rights groups have expressed concern that people could be forced into treatment. Janice Hahn is chair of the Los Angeles County Board of Supervisors.
Families are at the end of their ropes. Communities are frustrated. And leaders up and down the state have felt like our hands have been tied. It's a tool we will use to get people the care that they so desperately need.
People can contact their county care court to start the process. Care courts are also now open in Glen, Orange, Riverside, San Diego, Stanislaus, San Francisco, and Tuolumne counties. All counties are required to participate by the end of next year. Dr. Lisa Payan Berlin is president of Parents Anonymous, which runs the California Parent and Youth Helpline.
We are here to support people to deal with their underlying issues. There's a lot of fear of this new process called Care Court. Will it be caring? Will it be empathetic? Will they reject it? Is it punitive? Is it going to be helpful?
People can contact the helpline on the website, caparentyouthhelpline.org, or call or text them at 855-427-2736. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
The East County Magazine Show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interests, not special interests. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. Now stay tuned for part two of the East County Magazine radio show. Next up, we have some national news headlines from Public News Service in their 2023 talks.
Welcome to 2023 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Who could more easily subvert our democracy from within than a commander-in-chief who has already tried to do so before?
Attorney Jason Murray tells the Colorado Supreme Court a constitutional bar on insurrectionists in office applies to former President Donald Trump. A lower court ruled Trump did lead an insurrection, but the 14th Amendment clause doesn't apply to the presidency. Half of states have similar cases pending. Colorado's is one of the farthest along and could reach the Supreme Court. The Georgia legislature approved a new congressional map, keeping Republicans 9-5 edge. A federal court struck down a previous map with that split, saying lawmakers must draw a new black majority district. Republican State Representative Rob Leverett says they have, even if they've split the district of a sitting black congresswoman in the process.
We have not thumbed our nose at him. We have done what he told us to do. And these plans will comply, I feel, with his order. I take that obligation very, very seriously.
Critics want the court to appoint a special master to draw fair districts if lawmakers won't. 10 Wisconsin Republicans who filed paperwork falsely claiming Trump won the state in 2020 have admitted they were part of an effort to overturn the election. The admission comes after a suit by the group Law Forward, which includes lawyer Jeff Mandel.
This case has always been about trying to make sure that a small group of insiders cannot disregard the will of the voters and try to interfere with the peaceful transition of power.
Nevada became the third state this week to criminally charge fake electors following Georgia and Michigan. Extremism experts fear political violence next year and cite far-right conspiracy theories showing up in the mainstream. During Wednesday's GOP debate, businessman Vivek Ramaswamy repeated the lie that the left is encouraging migration to replace white people.
The great replacement theory is not some grand right-wing conspiracy theory, but a basic statement of the Democratic Party's platform.
Former Republican Virginia Congresswoman Barbara Comstock says many in the GOP got a flood of threats during the vote to consider Ohio Representative Jim Jordan as the speaker.
And when you had a member say, well, gee, if you vote for him, you won't get the death threats. Wow. That's how they think about it.
Comstock says the media should do a better job of challenging those who repeat so-called dog whistle calls for violence. Muslim activists are concerned a proposed congressional body with subpoena power could stoke Islamophobia. Robert McCall with the Council on Islamic Relations says a bill to create a commission to study anti-Semitism backed by the Anti-Defamation League could create friction in a time of fear.
Just recently, the ADL had sent letters to colleges questioning the free speech rights of Palestinian and Muslim students concerned about Israel's invasion of Gaza.
I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
December 7th marked the 82nd anniversary of the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor that brought the United States into World War II. It's important that voices that remember that day are not forgotten. So today we're going to replay an interview from several years ago with Dr. Kenneth Hansen. He's since passed on, but many of his patients and friends here in La Mesa, where he lived, may not know that he was also a young boy living in Honolulu when the Japanese attacked, and that as a Boy Scout, he became a messenger, ferrying messages between the U.S. military base and the hospital, a role that later inspired him to enter a medical career. This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine and KNSJ. Today, I'm very honored to have as my guest Ken Hansen, my next-door neighbor. All week, we've been talking with staff and friends and people across East County about their most interesting holiday recollections. And so today, Ken is going to share one of his. But first, a little bit of background. Ken, you were just a young man when your family moved to Hawaii in 1937. I understand that was a very auspicious day.
That is correct. We sailed on the old Malolo from Los Angeles to San Francisco and then to Hawaii. And the day that we sailed from San Francisco was the day that Amelia Earhart went down.
My goodness.
And which became the headline news for days and weeks.
Around the world.
So that was, in a sense, made that day very special that I remember sailing for Hawaii to live. And I was very excited about the whole thing. Also, we sailed under the Golden Gate Bridge, which just weeks after it had opened.
Ah, San Francisco.
That, too, was very exciting as I think back.
Now, fast forward a couple of years to December 7th, 1941. You were living in Honolulu that holiday season, or just before the Christmas season, when Pearl Harbor was bombed. What was the first inkling you had that something was very wrong?
I lived in Honolulu at the time. I was home with my father and a university student who lived with us.
And you were how old?
I was 13 in eighth grade, and we could hear noises off in the distance, rumblings. But there had been a lot of preliminary building up of defense type noises prior to this day as the possibility of war had escalated. So nothing much was made of these sounds except that one of us said, that must be Punch Bowl erupting.
The volcano.
Punch Bowl is an extinct volcano in Honolulu, which is now a national cemetery of renown.
But at that time,
it was a place where we went for picnics. Well, obviously, Punch Bowl wasn't erupting, and we had a frantic telephone call from my aunt, mm-hmm. who lived in a home on the beach beside Diamond Head, and she had seen with her own eyes a Japanese plane go by very low, so that she actually had eye contact, she thought, with the pilot.
Wow.
And she frantically called us and said that we are being attacked and don't move, like everybody else was saying.
Now, you were taking a typing class in school at the time, and I understand that that very night you sat down at home with your typewriter and you typed up a memoir. I can't
believe that I did it, but yes, I was taking typing. And, of course, it had just been to class, the last class on Friday.
Would you be willing to read it to us?
Sure. I'll read part of it, and we can talk about part of it, too.
And you've told me this was one of the most memorable days in your life?
This was indeed a memorable day in that things stand out so clearly even now, just as the other day in my life, my wedding day, stands out with great detail. I call this Memoirs of a Bombay Day. That was my 13-year-old sense of humor. We were having breakfast, as usual, on Sunday morning, Nabucco, the university student at our house, and I, when we heard a faint rumbling in the distance. Nabucco went to the door and said to me, Punch Bowl must be erupting. Well, we just laughed and forgot about that. And that was around 7:45 or 8 o'clock. And about a quarter to nine, I was getting ready to go to Sunday school, which I was supposed to do, when my aunt called frantically from where she lived off of Diamond Head on the beach and said, turn the radio on quickly, that Waianae was under fire. Waianae was one of the areas that was hit, but only one of many. We turned it on right away and were just in time to hear that Oahu was under attack, that we should stay calm, go at once to our houses, stay put, and keep the radio on all time. My father heard this, I'm ad-libbing now, and he found this very hard to believe, as did many people in the islands, that something actually bad was happening. They wanted to assume that this was practice.
Sure.
And it wasn't real, but it was real.
It had to be terrifying for you.
I wasn't terrified. This was a sense of thrill and excitement and fear all mixed up in a 13-year-old's mind. My mother was away at the time that this was happening.
Back to the memoir now.
Yes. When my daddy just laughed and said it was all practice or something like that, not to worry about it, she called, again, frantically like my aunt, and said what she was seeing. She happened to be working with a group of university students at an area called Aiea Heights, which overlooks Pearl Harbor, so she sat there and was seeing what was happening. And she, too, said, don't move, I'll get home with the car as soon as I can. She had three students that she had to take home first. Announcements kept coming over the wire saying for no one to go out on the streets and for everyone to get off and stay off them. Daddy still laughed and said that since Sunday school was not very far away that I might as well go. I refused. Meanwhile, we could see puffs of smoke coming up over the hills and hear what sounded like shooting and so forth. I begged to stay home. Then Mother got home, and she was able to describe precisely what she had been seeing. But I must say that even then, my father had trouble believing it. When he saw it in print, the first newspapers came out a little later in the morning through the neighborhoods, extra, extra, and he could see it. He gave in.
Your parents were very involved in this whole thing. Your mother, I understand, had a very close call herself.
She had to drive home, and there were several areas where anti-aircraft fire had come from Pearl Harbor into Honolulu. There was no actual bombing of Honolulu, but there were places where fires were started, and she could have been hit by an anti-aircraft.
It was shrapnel.
Shrapnel, yeah, whatever. Anyway, she got home safely, delivered her students, and all was well.
Your father worked at the university.
Yes. My dad worked for the Agricultural Extension Service at the University of Hawaii. And with his expertise, he and others in his office were immediately taken by the government. First of all, military rule took over immediately that day. Military rule was called. And he and others were called to the Capitol downtown. They cleared the throne room of the thrones and put in desks immediately. So the very next day, Monday, he was at a desk down there helping to assess the food situation for Oahu and the other islands, finding out how much was available and where it was available and how it was going to be distributed.
I understand that your father also wrote a memoir, Ken, of that time. Could you read a little bit of what he wrote?
He did, with considerable detail, and we are certainly grateful to him for having sat down and done that in the midst of a terribly busy time. He was working at the Extension Service in food distribution and production, and the director already had a job on the Territorial Food Committee, and they went to work even Sunday morning, and by Monday my father was in his office at the Capitol. Inventories of food and feed were made instantly. I'm reading from his own writing. The grocery stores were crowded and then ordered closed Tuesday for inventory. Note that the situation is different here than on the mainland. 65% of our food, and again I'm quoting, is imported, and if no ships come in, we eat sparingly. Wednesday, when the stores were opened and normal requirements were sold, but the shelves were low. The big wholesalers hold the keys, which appear to be good. There are relatively few wholesalers in town, and inventories were easily made. One small job I had to do was get information from 15 dealers of food by Monday morning between 11 and 11:45. The Central Committee met at Iolani Palace by noon. We are now standing by for more. This was written the day after.
Yeah, and your father's name was?
Kenneth Hansen.
Just like yours, so you're Kenneth Hansen.
Yep.
The second. Very good. Thank you for sharing that. So what was that first night like? Here you're at home, the island's just been bombed.
The first night was certainly memorable for an excitable 13-year-old.
You've written about it, I see.
Our house was situated on a hill, and we normally had a nice view with many lights to be seen. Of course, this was total blackout then, and we sat and peered out the windows at total blackness. And the big thing was not knowing, were they coming back? Were they coming back that night? Were they going to land the next day on the beaches? Were they coming to get us? What was going to happen?
We did
not know. Manoa Valley, where I lived, was usually bright with lights, and it was gray as the mountains behind it. Every so often we could see a blue light from a car, but they did not last long. About 8:15 we managed to find our beds and pile in them. I think all of us were glad to do so.
Now, you were active in the Boy Scouts at the time, and I understand that they helped with some of the things that needed to be done.
Yeah, at the time I was in Troop 1 of Honolulu, and the very next day, by afternoon, they had gotten hold of us and corralled us, and we met at a school, and we were trucked downtown Honolulu, where we were assigned to the city hall, well, other places too, but I was at the city hall. We helped with sandbagging.
Sandbagging to protect against shrapnel.
Building up against the buildings, yes. We were supposed to be messengers and take messages from one downtown building to another, which didn't particularly happen. But again, looking up the sky and hearing or seeing a plane made us wonder if they were coming back. Nobody knew who was coming or when. So that was part of the excitement and fear of the day. It was a mixture of excitement and fear.
Now, you also volunteered at a hospital with the Scouts.
Well, with the Scouts, we were out of school for 2 months or more.
No school for 2 months.
And most of the time we were busy, thanks to the Scouts, because we were assigned to such jobs as handing out gas masks at schools, helping with draft physicals because there was major drafting going on at the time, and working at a hospital, carrying boxes and doing whatever needed doing. Every place was a beehive of activity, and it was good. It kept us off the streets and doing something that was helpful.
There you go.
Yes, indeed.
Now, when Christmas came along, it was very different that year. Obviously, no holiday lights. The blackout was still in effect.
Total blackout. Christmas came along 2.5 weeks later.
Did you have a Christmas tree?
And no Christmas trees. A freighter carrying evergreens from the state of Washington was torpedoed somewhere between Washington and Honolulu, and that would have been most of the trees that people would have bought.
Mm-hmm.
So
what
down,
did you do?
Down they went. So we had to make do. We pulled up banana leaves and other things from the yard or the yard next door, and we cut out the ribbons and the ornaments and put them on. Of course, no lights, because at that time mm-hmm. we, at night, had only a storeroom with no windows to sit in if we wanted to be up and at 'em.
Wow.
Eventually, the kitchen was blacked off with denim and tape and stuff so we could sit in the kitchen. But it's pretty hot and humid in Hawaii, and it wasn't...
Yes, it is.
It wasn't pleasant sitting in a room all evening. So.
No, used to opening the windows and enjoying those ocean
yeah,
breezes.
Yeah, so then it had to be dark.
Now, for holiday dinner, was that affected?
I can't remember our holiday dinner. We were with my uncle and aunt and family, mm-hmm. and...
You've told me that traditionally in your family, your grandfather owned a turkey ranch someplace.
Yeah, we expected a turkey from California, since my grandfather owned a turkey ranch and usually had a turkey or two fattened up, especially for us, for the holidays.
But not that year.
No, it may have been that year we had it for Thanksgiving. I just don't remember. Mm-hmm. But otherwise, it probably went down on another ship.
Oh, my goodness. So this went on for 4 years. You stayed in the islands throughout the war, I understand.
Yes, yes. We stayed until it was time for me to go away to college. An amazing time to have lived there. In many ways, we were probably like normal teenagers, but our schooling was disrupted because the armed forces took over many of the schools. My particular school, called an intermediate school, was divided in three parts, and we were left with the Quonset hut-type part of the school, and the main part was taken over by the Army, and we had classes only half a day, and other parts of our school had to go to elementary schools that were available for other half days. So we were divided up into actually three parts and scattered around the city. And then when it came time for high school, 10th grade, and I was transferred to Punahou School, the Army had the school, and we were given and using a building at the University of Hawaii. Mm. The School of Education was our school until August of 1945, and the war was over, and the Army immediately gave the school back, and there was a frantic rush to put it back in order.
Now, you went on later in life to become a very successful doctor. Did those early days working in that hospital and seeing all the injuries and the suffering that you must have seen as a young man, did that influence your decision to want to help people by becoming a physician?
I'm pretty sure it did. I think really of those first days of the war when I got to be in the hospital and going all over and carrying things and having a feel for it. And then 2 years later, along around 10th grade, I had a summer job at the hospital where I really saw things going on and had a good feel for it and felt like I liked it. I didn't mind the sights and so mm-hmm. forth and so on, working with patients, carrying dishes, and so mm-hmm. forth.
Well, there you go.
So that must have been an influence as I look back, yes.
So often this time of year we hear the term peace on earth, and I think a lot of us probably don't stop to reflect on how much we take that for granted until you've been through something like the bombing of Pearl Harbor and have gone on to tell about that.
Yes, peace on earth escaped us that year, 1941, and through the awful years of the Second World War. And during this time I, of course, along with my schoolmates, matured and learned something about the world, and by the time the war was over, we knew an awful lot more than we did as eighth graders when it all started.
I can imagine. Well, Ken, thank you so much for joining us today on the East County Magazine show here on KNSJ.
It is a pleasure to be here and think about it and talk about it.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, bringing you public interest news from our region.
On December 24th, back in 1775, Juan Bautista de Anza's colonizing expedition from Spain spent the night in Coyote Canyon, an area that's now part of the Anza Borrego Desert in Borrego Springs. Writer Dick Overturf penned these words about that ordeal. It was Noche Buena, Christmas Eve, in Anza's camp. It was cold, foggy, and rainy. Earlier, it had been snowing. Everyone and everything was wet. Babies were crying. Women were weeping. Dead cattle lay on the ground. Hundreds of horses, mules, burros, and cattle were milling around Maria Gertrudis Rivas, who was in labor. Few could sleep, and the mountain Cahuilla Indians were watching. Who were these intruders? The soldiers and settlers in De Anza's expedition had been on the march north from Mexico for 87 days when they reached Coyote Canyon. seeking the promised land at Mission San Gabriel. An earthquake struck that night also, rattling the group's composure amid the bitter cold. After Friar Pedro Font recited evening prayers or vespers, Colonel Anza distributed a potent brandy drink, aguardiente, to raise his soldiers' morale. Friar Font took offense, declaring that it is not right to celebrate the birth of the infant Jesus with drunkenness, to which Danza replied, "I do not give it to them to get drunk." He insisted that the king had ordered the brandy for the soldiers, but warned that if any soldier was found drunk outside his tent, he would be punished. Friar Font later reported that the people that night were so noisy, singing and dancing from the effects of the liquor, not caring that we were in so bad a mountain in the rain, and so delayed with the saddle animals and tired cattle, but such is the rule of those absolute lords. This was not the first time Friar Font had scolded the expedition's commander. Just 1 week earlier, a fandango, or jubilant dance and feast, was held. The fandango at San Felipe, said Font, was somewhat discordant, and a very bold widow who came with the expedition sang some verses which were not at all nice, applauded and cheered by all the crowd. Now, at the Christmas Eve encampment in Coyote Canyon, after the celebration died down, the friar comforted a soldier's wife who had been in labor since the day before. "She was fearful of dying, and I consoled her as best I could," he wrote. Shortly before midnight on Christmas Eve, the soldier's wife gave birth to a baby boy, who was christened Salvador Ignacio Linares. He was the third child born on the expedition, and the first white child born in California. A monument honoring the baby's birth on the eve of the nativity still stands today, about 2.25 miles from Anza Ridge, near the San Diego County line. The day after the child's birth, the weary band of travelers rested before continuing on their way. Father Font delivered a sermon and then wished them all Feliz Navidad, or Merry Christmas.
It's time to deck the halls for the holiday season, but some holiday decorations can pose safety hazards for your cat or dog. So San Diego County's Animal Service Department is offering these tips to protect your pet. Keep pets away from mistletoe, holly, and poinsettias, since these are toxic to animals. Consider using artificial holiday plants instead. Chocolate is toxic to pets, so keep stockings with chocolate treats out of reach, as well as any chocolate cookies you might leave out for Santa. Anchor your Christmas tree so pets can't tip it over. Clear fishing twine tied to the top of the tree and secured to a ceiling or wall is a simple way to keep your tree standing and protect your ornaments too. Never use tree preservatives in water in your Christmas tree stand, since this can be deadly if cats or dogs drink it. Cats love to play with tinsel and curling ribbon, but then they'll try to eat it. Tinsel is toxic and ribbon can obstruct your pet's intestinal tract, so keep these items away from curious critters. Hide electrical cords from your pets and make sure they can't play with or knock over any candles. Many dogs and cats get overwhelmed with all the hustle and bustle of the holidays, so having a quiet room allows them to escape and sleep undisturbed. On New Year's Eve, loud booms from fireworks can scare your canine companion. Some dogs will jump over fences to escape the noise. They run for miles and become lost, so set aside a safe, quiet place and be sure your dog is wearing identification just in case. Microchip both dogs and cats, since they slip out the door unnoticed while you're busy greeting holiday visitors. And if someone finds your lost pet, a vet's office or shelter can scan for a microchip, and you can easily be reunited. County Animal Service offers low-cost microchipping every Tuesday through Sunday, which includes national registration. You can also sign up for Finding Rover and upload a photo of your pet using your computer or smartphone. This free service uses facial recognition to help lost and found dogs be reunited with their owners. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Chardé Fontenot.
This is East County Magazine's People Power, profiling local people making a positive difference in our community and our world.
The Lemon Grove City Council has unanimously voted to move forward with installing all new playground structures at Lemon Grove Park, thanks to the Proposition 68 per capita grant program. This non-competitive grant provides funding to local government agencies to support the rehab, creation, and improvement of local parks and to address deficiencies in neighborhoods lacking access to outdoor recreational facilities. Lemon Grove currently only has two parks with playground equipment and a rec center that lost all funding more than 12 years ago. Back in November 2021, the council directed staff to apply for the grant funding to rehab Lemon Grove Park. In January of last year, the city was awarded funding of more than $194,000. The remaining $18,000 will be paid from the general fund. City staff worked with Miracle Recreation Equipment Company to decide what scope and features could be made possible with the funding. Staff decided on a design sure to make kids and families with all types of different needs very happy. Lemon Grove Park has had the same equipment for more than 20 years, according to Public Works Director Izzy Merguia. The new playground equipment will include a new play area for children ages 2 to 5 and a separate section for kids 5 to 12 with climbing gear and slides. Lemon Grove Park will also soon have new sensory equipment, a swing set with 6 swings instead of just 2, and it will include ADA accessible, inclusive, and generational swing seats, as well as new shade structures. The park upgrades are expected to be completed in the latter half of 2024. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
Our East County Magazine radio show needs volunteers, and so does our award-winning news website at eastcountymagazine.org. If you would like to help write scripts, learn reporting skills, research topics for our news team, or have an on-air voice to be the media, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617.
The East County Magazine Show airs Mondays and Fridays on KNSJ from 5 o'clock to 6 o'clock p.m. You can listen live at 89.1 FM or online at knsj.org. You can also listen anywhere by downloading the TuneIn application for your smartphone. For details, visit tunein.com. This concludes today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technician, Jonathan Getz, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, A.K. Jewel, Brian Boyko, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road, Blues 3 Music, and Pond 5. If you would like to underwrite or sponsor the East County Magazine radio show or get involved as a volunteer on our public interest news show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We'll be back soon with another edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show.
A free press is the foundation of our democracy. KNSJ Radio is dedicated to providing nonprofit news in the public interest, not special interests. We rely on your support to continue bringing you important stories from San Diego and East County that you won't hear anywhere else. Please make a generous donation at knsj.org to sustain KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.